Melody Wright, housing analyst, strategist, and author of the M3 Melody Substack. Welcome to The Competent Investor. Thanks for joining me.
Thank you so much for having me. It's my pleasure.
So, Melody, I'd like to start today by speaking about, let's say, the changes in the past year in the housing market and really what that is starting to tell us about the average American consumer.
Yeah, if you're just looking at the national statistics, it looks kind of a lot like more of the same. I mean, we're entering our fourth season of what you can call a frozen housing market. Now, every month they're going to say, oh, sales are up, sales are down. But that's just, there's quite a seasonal arc to housing. And so sales are going to be up in the spring season up through June. And then, you know, they start to kind of normalize. So despite those headlines, we are basically just reliving the same script. In fact, we're about a percent, we're like year to date with sales. When you look at both, I combine new and existing sales to look at that combined number. We're about 1% behind last year, year to date right now. We're probably going to see sales up this month. That's typical, but it looks like they're going to be up a little bit year over year, and they should be because rates are much lower than this time last year. But if you remember what was happening this time last year, we were kind of slightly recovering from the tariff terror, which kind of just put a halt on the housing market. So we were just starting to kind of come out of that. So year over year, sales are going to be up. But what's happened, what everybody cares about, I care a lot about sales because I can tell you, you know, when we get a volume of sales, we actually get price discovery. We actually see price declines because things are selling. But, you know, unfortunately, you know, where we're not selling, you're still seeing. Like, so let's take last month in May, existing home sales in the Northeast were down 7% year over year. They were down 2.2% year over year in the Midwest. And that is the only place that you saw home prices even like kind of, I'm calling it floating up. Now, the Northeast is doing a little more than floating because it's just, it's so delusional and there's so few sales there. But it's starting to turn over, especially in places like Boston, Pittsburgh, Philadelphia. But anyway, but what everybody cares about is prices and not necessarily sales. I'm looking at sales. And so what we've basically seen is we've seen the South and the West come under pressure. You're seeing year over year. So a lot is happening under the surface of those national statistics. So for example, you know, a year ago, I tracked 86 markets, 23 of those markets were year over year negative for prices. This year, there are 33. So we've just been making this steady, slow progress through the country. And the South and West have taken most of those home price declines. But as I was just saying, the Midwest and the Northeast are starting to roll over in many of those big locations. The Midwest specifically, Indianapolis and Kansas City. And so, you know, what I think will probably happen this year is we will actually get to a year-over-year price decline in the back half of the year because the people that can transact will be pulling back from the market, while those that are in distress will be a bigger part of the sales. And we are definitely seeing that delinquent population tick up now that the guardrails have been put on that FHA program. And all on the prime book side, the modifications there just aren't doing the trick. But I just said a whole bunch, so I'm going to stop and see what you want to pull on there.
Well, I was going to say, Melody, you know, going through your latest Substack, it was quite actually surprising to me that we've seen this decline over the last 4 years, right? 2021 was the last real year that we saw, let's say, above the average 27-year, was it average price or average sales numbers?
Well, both, but the chart you were looking at was average sales. And so, yeah, like that's, I track both, but yeah, it's insane. It's actually insane. And what's even more insane is that we've increased population by 20% since then. So these are absolute numbers. Mm-hmm. They're absolute. So we have absolutely seen sales sort of, you know, lower than 2007. You know, we're kind of running right now on track. When you look at combined sales, we're running on track with 2008. You know, so it's just wild to actually comprehend, and the fact that really hardly anyone's talking about it. I mean, you don't really hear about it. Like, you know, by the time we were at this point in the last cycle, you know, same percentage of subprime, same. Actually, we have a higher delinquency level on the FHA book than we saw, say, on the private subprime last time. People were screaming from, you know, the rooftops. But the difference is, you know, everybody thinks that subprime mortgages caused the last crisis. It was really a collateral shortage in the system around those, you know, derivative products from the subprime market. But in reality, subprime could have never taken the whole system down itself. It was just, we suddenly arrived at a lack of confidence. Mm-hmm.
Well, and as you're explaining this, I'm trying to think of different scenarios or different explanations, right? And to think that a year ago, we were just kind of coming out of the tariff tantrum and things like that is wild to think that it was only a year ago, considering all of the things that have happened. But what do you think explains this drop over the last real 4 years? Is it confidence? Is it mortgage rates? Is it, you know, is it demographics? What do you, or is it all of them that kind of play in this together?
It's all of the above and more. And I just think, you know, one, we have an affordability crisis. Like, it, you know, I just tell people, keep it simple, right? Take the household median income times three. That's what your median home price should be. It's just that simple. It, I mean, through decades, you know, people in this industry that know credit know you never should spend more than 30% on your shelter. And really, even, you know, it probably should be lower because we've seen such increases in property tax and insurance. But what, you know, what got us here were so many things. But during COVID, we pulled forward demand, not as much as you think. In reality, what it was is a bunch of speculators. And I mean, I've met so many of these millennials on the road that tell me, yeah, you know, me and my partner moved in together, but I bought a house myself and, you know, we were going to flip it or we're going to rent it out or we were going to Airbnb. And sometimes they did. And sometimes they couldn't afford to do the repairs and it's just sitting there. And so you had just a ton. And this has really been happening since the late 80s. You know, people were taught to see their house as an investment, mm-hmm. not as shelter. And so therefore, you know, housing has become a casino. And a lot of the building that happened during the last cycle was about speculation as well. It wasn't, and this is what so many people get wrong when they talk about the inventory shortage. It's like they don't realize we didn't need all that housing back then. You know, we've got more housing per capita than we've ever had right now. And they're still building. And that's the crazy. And our demographics just don't support it. So, you know, it was a whole bunch of things, but it was, you know, Airbnb gone wild, you know, speculation gone wild. You know, everybody, what's so crazy is people are like, oh, everybody's moving, let's say, to New Albany, Ohio, which is where you have a massive data center complex. It's like, no, the investors went and bought and built mm-hmm. in New Albany because somehow those 10 people that are going to work at that data center is going to, you know, inhabit all those homes. No. You know, yeah, right now there's 25,000 construction workers on site in New Albany, but that's temporary. That's temporary. But we built like it was permanent. And we did that all over the country and not even just the Sun Belt. You can go look at infill on the Northeast. But really for them, their biggest issue is demographics and that everybody's leaving the Northeast because of crazy tax policies. That's what's happening in Boston. They're dealing with their second year in a row of double digit property tax increases. And because a city like Boston is going to have a very low owner occupancy, because those cities, investors buy in there because they can rent to young people coming for college or their first job or whatever. Well, those people are having to get out because they aren't cash flowing anymore. You know, that property has now become, it used to be like this nice cash cow. Now it's, you know, it's an albatross around their necks. Mm-hmm.
You're currently doing some work around the land speculation cycle. So what is this and how does it play into this as well?
So I love history, and I love, you know, and I read about every prior mania and ridiculousness. And so I've always studied these things. Well, I met this very smart lady in Australia who had seen some of my videos, and she wanted to interview me, and we started talking. She works for something, I think it's called the Land Cycle Institute, and she introduced this theory to me, which many economists, many academics kind of arrived at this theory independent of one another across the centuries. But by looking at 250 years of history, you can basically chart out the land speculation cycle, and it's about 18.6 years. And so people could call 2008, like, you know, 15 years before it happened, and you go back and it fits. So I'm the kind of person, I read something, it's interesting, I have to spend then a ton of time on it to, you could kind of validate, but it passes the sniff test. I have a lot more work to do, but I think what I missed in this, and even though I knew it, I don't think I put the pieces together as much, is that really the data center story is also a real estate story. So I've been watching this frozen housing market for 4 years. Like, how can this still be, like, what are we doing here? Like, we peaked out in 22. Like you say, the last time we really had great sales was 21. Like, what is, you know, and I've often argued that what has kept it going has been the NVIDIA narrative, the AI narrative, the data center build out. But you have to actually see these two are the same thing in many ways. And the speculation around these data centers is real estate speculation. And I think it is also, you know, winding down as people realize that they can't build these data centers. We don't have the resources. And in fact, most of the ones that are in progress right now aren't going to have the power or the water. So, you know, I think we're nearing the end. What I have to do more work on is figuring out where exactly are we? You know, some people simply say, oh, it's, you know, when prices bottom, but that doesn't actually work if you look at the last two cycles, at least, because prices bottomed for us in 2012. That's in the United States. But I actually think we're probably in year 17, if not already year 18, but like it just turned to year 18. And so, you know, we shall see from here. But I mean, you look through history and you look at other great manias like the railroad build out and things like this. And I mean, the paradigm fits. And so we shall see, you know, I have more work to do on it, but it's very compelling.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I found it really interesting to read about. And the fact that from, as you say, from 2008, that puts us squarely in 2026, right?
I wish that I had read it before I made some stupid forecast, but you know, but yeah.
Well, as you rightly point out many times, you know, there's more data to be taken into consideration. And just because you are maybe thinking out loud doesn't mean that that's exactly, you know, no, that is going to be black and white, that is going to happen. It's always a problem that we deal with in the information space, right?
And silly me, you know, it's like I come from financial planning analysis. This is where I spent most of my time, FP&A. You know, we did a forecast every month. I mean, we know what forecasts are. We know how many times. But, you know, the public is, and it's probably not even the public. It's probably the bots. But, you know, they're just, they can be very nasty about it. So, but yeah, it's just your best guess. I mean, you can base it on a lot of data, a lot of science, but it's still, you have no idea what's going to happen. And I think that too many people just try to be certain and be absolutists on their takes. And I just kind of, I've learned to roll with it and just, you know, every new thing that comes, I study it, I try to figure it out, and then I incorporate it, you know. Mm-hmm.
So I wanted to go back, as you say, like looking through this lens of history to inform us. I read something that was quite interesting to me that I've never heard about, was that the idea that the Florida land speculation caused the Great Depression.
Yes. Yeah. So Bubble in the Sun is a fantastic book. And, you know, I'd never heard that either. I mean, I think you, the more you study the Great Depression, the less you know. I don't know if you've had that same experience, but it's just like, it reminds me so much of this time. There's so much that was going on. And then there were so many policy responses that were tried that didn't work and then made it worse. Or maybe some people think it did, some people don't. But, you know, to me, again, this was just a really good, when I read it, I was like, whoa, I recognized it. I mean, I just recognized what was happening. I also recognized all those places they were talking about because I spent a lot of time down there in 2008. Well, not 2008, like in the aftermath, like around 2012. Like I spent a lot of time in Florida. There's another great book called Swamp Peddlers, and it's very similar. But yeah, you know, this and then that and that fits right into that land cycle as well. Mm-hmm.
So getting back to the present day here, Melody, when we think about, let's say, concerning signs within the industry, are delinquencies kind of that, let's say, the albatross that you have to be looking at that is really kind of blinking red?
You have to understand credit and you have to understand delinquency. And what I've started to realize is that there's just hardly anybody left in this space that understands delinquency, especially in mortgage. They're all retired or retiring. Like you take someone like Bill McBride, who, you know, was around the last cycle. He's retiring in May. So the people that understand delinquency are gone. And so I happen to manage default. I understand it. I've watched it very closely. And you know, you could see all of this happening in slow motion. In reality, we saw the FHA, which just for your viewers is what I'll call government subprime. This is supposed to be for first-time home buyers. That's not how it works, actually. But it's low credit scores as low as 580. You can actually even go lower with compensating factors and very low down payment, 3.5%. If you even have to pay that, oftentimes you can get down payment assistance. So we saw this start to go delinquent in June of 23. We saw what I'll call the death cross. And what that is in mortgage, when you go 30 days delinquent, that's going to get reported to your credit. And that's a big deal. And we're obsessed with our credit in the United States. And so when you make that decision to let it go over that threshold, you've asked mom, you've asked your grandparents, you've gone to try to get a payday loan. You have done everything that you possibly can, and it's over. Mm-hmm. And so that happened in June of 23. The administration responded at that time with a very aggressive loss mitigation program, something so they got crazy in COVID. You know, back after the last cycle, we did loan modifications, but you had to actually, we underwrote them and made sure you could qualify. Well, they stopped doing that in COVID. You didn't have to even prove that the borrower could pay. They just sent them out in the mail and said, your new payment is X. Well, then on top of that, the Biden administration did this crazy program where, let's say that you were 3 months delinquent. You could go to the servicer and say, hey, I'm 3 months delinquent. They say, hey, no problem. We're going to put that balance at the back of your loan in a non-interest bearing lien. Let's say you didn't pay for 3 more months. You just went back and got another one and then another one and then another one and then another one. And you could do that up to 30% of your unpaid principal balance. And so think about that. The home was probably around 500, 450. That is a ton of money that you could put to the back. Well, so April of last year, so a year ago, Scott Turner locked that program down and said you could only get one of those like every 18 months. You would also have to make trial payments to prove that you could pay for it. And what we knew is they were going to fail out at an alarming rate. And that's what they have been doing. And so those guidelines went on in October. Delinquency takes a very long time now with all of the restrictions that went on after the last crisis. So yes, delinquency is what everybody should watching. And what I was watching this year specifically, Tom, is that delinquency, just like everything else, has a season. It typically peaks in December around Christmas in the United States because you went and spent too much. I'm sure you've done it. I've done it, you know. And then in the spring, you get your tax refund, which was supposed to be much bigger this year. And you also get your bonus. And so this year I thought, well, we probably won't see unseasonal delinquency. We're just going to see this buildup from the FHA. Well, month one comes, we see it. Month two, we see it. Month three. And this is, even I am shocked because I really thought that those, you know, I was believing that those tax refunds would have such an impact. But with gas prices rising, to your point, the consumer is just, they are, you know, they were already tapped out. I mean, they were like at the lower end of the K, the middle of the K, even like, you know, you can get to that little part of the K. They were completely tapped out, but those gas prices, I mean, just it with food inflation not going down, and then services inflation and healthcare inflation. I mean, all of this, the consumer is just completely dead. And so, and then you tack on the layoffs where severance is running out. And yeah, I mean, we are seeing this delinquency, and those tax refunds didn't do a thing to stop it. And it's in mortgage. And anybody that watches the household debt and credit report that the Fed puts out, you can look at the balances of credit cards, of student loans, and then you just see this giant, it's mortgage. And so everyone at this point, when mortgage starts rolling over with delinquency, then we are in trouble. And that is exactly what's starting to happen right now.
If you learned anything interesting from this episode, please let me know in the comments. And don't forget to subscribe. This helps us get more guests for the show. This channel is listener supported over on Substack, where we have more on offer, like weekly episodes for subscribers only, enhanced show notes, and a community where we can engage together.